are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Michael Negler. It's October 30th, so we are in the Halloween and Day of the Dead season, and today's show is not only going to be about all of the nonviolence in the news, but it's going to be about the energy behind nonviolence, which at its core is about accepting the meaning of life and overcoming our fear of death. So let's turn first to nonviolence in the news. Michael.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. And I think I'd like to start today's edition of Nonviolence in the News with a human interest item. You know, this is where you will normally get news that you don't hear on the mainstream media and also analysis of the news, even if you do. But today, as I say, an interesting little item. People have thought of all kinds of ways of promoting anti-war sentiment, and one of them is called the Miss Grand International Beauty Contest, which takes place in Thailand. And they are searching for women to encourage and run the campaign, quote, Stop the War and Violence, to help encourage people to avoid the conflict and violence that may lead to war in any form. Now, it just so happens that I have a friend who just came back from Calcutta, and he picked up some newspapers on the plane, and another friend of mine was perusing them, and he saw this interesting article about a woman named Vartika Singh, who, 24 years old, she's from a little village near the city of Lucknow. There's a lot of nonviolent stuff going on in the region of Uttar Pradesh that I'll be mentioning later on in this segment. And she won the runners-up for Miss Grand International. She was asked, who has really inspired you, or what do you find inspiring? And she said immediately, an eye for an eye will make the whole world blind. She talked about how much she owed to Gandhi. A simple man inspired the whole world, she said. If I go on to win the coveted title, I would use it to spread the word about Ahimsa, like he did. So I guess we are everywhere. Now, to mention a couple of resources, this episode, my resources are mainly from Waging Nonviolence, which had a very good collection this week at wagingnonviolence.org, and I'm going to talk about two books. There's a number of books that we can turn to learn about the Palestinian unarmed struggle, one by Sua Dajami called Eyes Without Country. Mary King, who just did a very interesting webinar yesterday with the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict on a particular campaign of Gandhi's which took place in 1924, the Vicom Temple Road Satyagraha. And I listened in and commented on it. She wrote a book called A Quiet Revolution. Then there's another book called Refusing to Be Enemies, which is a long series of interviews with Israeli and Palestinian activists. Andrew Rigby writes one called The First Palestinian Intifada Revisited. It's an episode that we have also written about. And now there's a book coming out by Andrew and Marwan Darwish, both very well-known names in this field. The book is called Popular Protest in Palestine, The Uncertain Future of Unarmed Resistance. This book is going to give us a highly knowledgeable, well-written, and balanced treatment of nonviolent action, by and in support of Palestinian aspirations. They make an interesting point about a controversial feature of nonviolence in the occupied territories and in Gaza. Quote, "It is probably better to call the First Intifada and other such Palestinian struggles unarmed rather than nonviolent. And that's because of the youth who have been in the habit of throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. And while on the one hand, only one Israeli soldier has ever been injured in the course of all of this stone throwing, the Palestinians themselves regard it as a symbolic move, and it's to express their defiance and that they're not going away. But it, you know, it's a threatening thing to have someone throw stones at you. So it kind of sits there on the fence, and most of us would feel uncomfortable calling this nonviolence. You know, now that I've mentioned it, we are going to be hearing later on this year from Mubarak Awad, a dear friend and one of the architects of that first intifada. He told me a story not long ago about a Palestinian kid who, 12 years old, I think, threw a stone at a patrol jeep that was going by, an IDF jeep, and a soldier jumped out of the jeep and chased him, which is kind of standard procedure, beat him up kind of badly, which again is unfortunately standard procedure. This intrepid youth, mastering his fear, showed up the next morning at the same corner and threw a stone again at the same soldiers. So same soldier jumps out, chases him, and beats him up. Third day, the kid, of course, at this point, he can't run very fast. He gets caught by the soldier. And guess what? The soldier gives him a big hug and goes back to his jeep. And this young man went to Mubarak and actually complained. Why did he hug me? Mubarak said, because he's human. And I think there's a good lesson for all of us, not just for that 12-year-old boy. Well, there's another book coming out on a very different issue and very different episode. It's by Andrea Needham, and it's called The Hammer Blow. It's about a story which I had no idea about 10 women who carried out a plowshares action in England and disarmed a Hawk attack aircraft at the British Aerospace factory in Lancashire. This plane was going to be delivered to the Indonesian military, and they were using them against civilians in East Timor, which Indonesia had illegally occupied. And it's interesting that they tried everything before they did their plowshares action. So I want to cite that because this is standard nonviolent procedure. This is how you do it. Even if you don't think there's going to be a response, you give your opponent a chance to respond. So they had 3 years of campaigning to stop the sale of this airplane and others with it. Together with thousands of people all over the country, Andrea says, I had written letters, signed petitions, taken part in public meetings, rallies and marches, and organized acts of civil disobedience. Nothing had worked. The planes were about to be delivered. The only thing left to do was to disarm them ourselves. They did that. They banged on them with hammers. And one of those hammers, incidentally, they had written on the handle a verse from Deuteronomy, I have set before you life and death, therefore choose life, that your children may live. That fits into our theme for today, that hammer does. And they were completely acquitted of all charges, because there is a principle that you can use reasonable force to prevent a crime. And they argued that they'd been using reasonable force, no body was hurt, to prevent the crime of genocide in East Timor. The jury listened carefully and acquitted them of all charges. That's really a nice episode. Now, another resource I want to mention, there is an article in the New York Times on the 26th of October by the editorial board, an editorial rather than an article called The Concealed Carry Fantasy. and they cited the evidence that showed that encouraging citizens to carry concealed weapons does not transform the citizens into superheroes. Rather, it compounds the risks to innocent lives. Tellingly, since 2007, at least 763 people have been killed in 579 shootings that did not involve self-defense. The vast majority of these concealed carry licensed shooters either killed themselves or others rather than taking down a perpetrator. This is not to mention the phenomenon, I will add, of victim-precipitated suicide, where people pull out a weapon and get themselves killed immediately. So that's it for the resources sections. Now to move on to events and campaigns, and there is so much going on around our world. There's a website called attn.org, which obviously means attention, and they have a very simple mission: to inform and empower the next generation to make a social impact. And they recently carried an article about a campaign called Abolish the Box. The Student Peace Alliance and many others are playing a major role in this campaign. And the issue is this, that when you register for school in certain areas of the country, there's a little box that you have to check off saying that you've never been arrested for a crime of one kind or another. Once again, studies show that there is no correlation between increased campus safety and this kind of criminal record screening. Furthermore, the research is indicating that the presence of these questions is a major deterrent for people with records who have taken a step to better their lives through education. So once again, it's disproportionately affecting people of color and people who are economically disadvantaged. And tragically, it's preventing them from taking the one step that we know for sure will help to restore them to a more productive life, and that is education. So I'm very, very happy to say that the students themselves have taken on this campaign. Now, other news in the USA, in Denver, Colorado, 200 people marched against a decision to stop the building of a homeless shelter and to demand more shelters for the homeless, and they collected 13,000 signatures. The story is on popularresistance.org if you want to look further into it. Then back in my old hometown, New York City, activists in Park Slope, which is a very, very well-off district, they got their residents to put in perspective how communities of color interact with the police forces, which, of course, is a very hot issue right now. The group is called Police Reform Organizing Project, or PROP, and they handed out, I really like events that do humorous offbeat things like this. They handed out fake summonses to white individuals who were committing small crimes that blacks have recently been arrested for. And this is a very gentrified area, Park Slope. And again, this one is on waging nonviolence. But I've been saving the big one, which is going to take place in Paris in December. The Climate Action Summit is going to take place, probably ending around December 11th or 12th. They usually run over time. And the general sentiment among climate action activists is that it will be inconsequential, just like all the others, and they must mobilize to take control back from the corporations and the governments and to do it ourselves from the ground up. An enormous coalition has come together and started something called red lines. Red lines meaning they're going to draw red lines beyond which they will not accept actions that tend to damage the climate. And again, you can read about this in Waging Nonviolence, which is a very good source this week. And They are talking about determined disobedience using nonviolent methods and not escalating police violence, but being absolutely determined to prevent corporations from going beyond a certain point. And if you've seen the film recently by Bill McKibben called Do the Math, you'll see that scientists know now exactly what some of those red lines have to be. So going even further abroad, in Tripoli, in Libya, youth fight the violent unrest with peaceful action, the story is called. A 19-year-old named Hayat Shaban is a graphic artist in Tripoli, and he speaks out against violence, as does a female youth pianist who recently uploaded a video of her playing piano as bombs exploded in her city, reminiscent of what happened in Serbia and other parts of that whole region, especially in Sevastopol. In South Africa, there's been a partial victory for hashtag fees must fall. That's a movement which is demanding that President Zuma announce that there will be no increase in university fees, and he has just done so. I kind of regard this as much more than just not wanting to pay more money. It has something to do with the freedom of education and the ability of students to function and to organize. Recently, another event that ended successfully, the largest coal mine in the UK was shut down. Four protesters climbed down into the depths of the mine called the Shotton Mine, which is run by Banks Mining, and fastened themselves to a 500-ton coal excavator and brandished a banner bearing the slogan End Coal, while another group of around eight people blocked the main entrance to the site by lying in front of the gate. And this is a mine that's, you know, right outside of Newcastle, if you remember the slogan, bringing coal to Newcastle. Well, they're preventing them from getting coal out of Newcastle. So let's go back to Lucknow in Uttar Pradesh now for just a minute in India. This is a type of issue which is very typical, and we've reported on it before in many parts of the world, Hawaii, Central America, and that's where corporations, with the connivance and the cooperation of the local, well, the national government in the country of issue, has taken on some kind of extractive industry which dislodges, without any kind of compensation usually, indigenous people. And we're right now talking about a dam that's under construction now for several years. It would submerge over 10,000 acres and ruin 110 villages in Uttar Pradesh and the neighboring states of Chhattisgarh, where there's been a lot of violence, actually, and not on this issue, and Jharkhand, and displace thousands of local people and disrupt their lives and livelihood. The dam was approved by the Central Water Commission of India in 1976, but it was abandoned in 1989 after facing fierce opposition from these local people. It's a well-known phenomenon in nonviolence and social revolution generally, that there's a difference between poverty and destitution. People will put up with a lot of poverty, but when they're going to be, when their lives are going to be destroyed, when they can't get medical help for their children and their families, when they're pushed up against that wall, they will fight back. And that's exactly what's happening to these people. It's not just this dam, but near Lucknow in Uttar Pradesh, there is a bauxite mine, or rather, there is a large mountain that has bauxite in it. And again, for years, the indigenous people have been trying to prevent their government and international companies from getting at that mine. And you can read about that in a book by Arundhati Roy called Walking with the Comrades, about the Maoist element that's in India. And of course, she's such a brilliant writer that you just never forget that story. So I just would like to end, Stephanie, with a few events that are local and that people may want to participate in, although we know that we have readership all over the world, and we welcome their sending in events in their parts of the world. But Oak Flat Mine, in there is going to be a 2015 Hall of Fame dinner for Ann Kirkpatrick, and there are protesters, and Facebook Events has that news. The protest is going to be held, by the way, I'm talking about Phoenix, Arizona, and the protest is going to be held at 100 North 3rd Street, at the, which is the Phoenix Convention Center, coming up in a few days. More locally, every Friday, on into mid-November, there is a vigil in support of Palestinians, and we are going to have two Palestinians on this program in the short while. So this, we are now talking about Santa Rosa, Mendocino Avenue at Courthouse Square between 3rd and 4th Street. Make your own signs. Come every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. There's also, looking south now, the Kingian Nonviolence Training, which is going to take place November 14th from 10 in the morning till 4:30 at the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz, an organization that we have visited and feel very close to. And they're asking for a sliding scale donation of $45 to $95. But again, as has become common in our movement, no one turned away for lack of funds. RCNV.org is the place to go for more information. That Resource Center is also putting on workshops on undoing institutionalized racism in November. And I think that is where I will conclude today's episode of Nonviolence in the News.
Well, before you conclude, Michael, thank you very much for your news. And I have a few questions in terms of how you chose the stories that you did, because for our listeners of Peace Paradigm Radio, they need to also learn how to find this kind of news themselves besides going on to Waging Nonviolence or Popular Resistance. How can they see through an action to understand the nonviolence underneath it and tell themselves a different story? So a lot of what you reported had to do with confrontation.
Right.
Is all nonviolence in the news about this kind of confrontation? Can you speak to that?
Whoa, that's a very good question, Stephanie. And of course, some of the items that I report on of late are collected by our intern, Mercedes Mack, who's been well trained. And she does look to those traditional sources, by now traditional sources of popular resistance and waging nonviolence. But also there are items in the newspapers that people don't recognize have nonviolent content to them. Mm-hmm. And you're quite right that nonviolence is not by any means limited to protest and confrontation. I mentioned in the case of the women in the UK how they had attempted to persuade by standard means, you know, letters, rallies, and so forth. But they felt that what was going on had to be stopped. And so at the appropriate time, they escalated to confrontational maneuvers, and in fact, involving property destruction, which again is one of those gray areas where we're not sure exactly whether we should call it nonviolence or not. I'm comfortable with that kind of property destruction, for matter of that. But no, I guess people have to have sort of a general sense of what the dynamics of nonviolence are, and then look at the news through those lenses. I remember from years back, now, I mean, I'm going to date myself now. The Iran hostage crisis, 1979. It was going on, and I went out to go for a swim. I was teaching on campus, and in the locker room, there was a newspaper. It was lying there on the bench, and the headline said, "What U.S. could do to Iran." Mm-hmm. In other words, implicitly, to do anything to Iran meant to do something harmful to them. What kind of sanction could we use to hurt them? Mm-hmm. And about a year or so after that happened, we had a lecture by Johann Galtung, the well-known peace researcher and nonviolence scholar. And he said that what Jimmy Carter could have done was apologized to the Iranians for the role of the United States in the destruction of the career of Mohammad Mossadegh, who is sometimes known as the Gandhi of Iran, who was a very popular prime minister. But the CIA, along with M16 and Mossad, brought him down and instead installed Shah Reza Pahlavi, which unleashed a regime of violence and torture that we, the Iranian people, are still suffering from today.
Right.
So if Carter had done that, Galtung said, he would have been gone down in history as the greatest president America had ever known. He would have gotten the Nobel Prize, and he would have been impeached.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of finding that news, though, in a different way, how can... Are we telling a story, basically, of a different kind of power?
Yes.
And so anytime that we're hearing a bias toward a certain kind of power, it's undoing that news when we say, well, what was the agency of human individuals? What did they believe about themselves? And what did they believe that was possible about the world? Mm-hmm. And with those in mind, we can help to construct a different framework for how we interpret the news.
Quite right. And I think that different framework would involve elements that don't necessarily leap out at us and say, this has to do with nonviolence.
Right.
But when you get used to what to look for, you can connect the dots. And one of my favorite examples is how newspapers are constantly reporting on old science, on classical science. Even though it's been out of date in some cases now for 100 years, they roll merrily on telling you that they've just discovered the gene that makes you vote liberal Democrat or like peanut butter or something like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas we know perfectly well that genes really can't by themselves do things like that to us, and that our agency is being undermined by this old paradigm. And it's not even good science. I mean, there's just really no excuse for it anymore.
Okay, so that would be an interesting project for the Meta Center, I think, then to explore and to integrate the new science into the news, because that's kind of nonviolence in the news, too, if you think about it, that there's new discoveries in science being made at the same time as that is explaining what this other kind of power is that people have.
In fact, the new discoveries are coming in so thick and fast that we can hardly keep up with them. We have a team of 5 people working on the creation of a science section or set of pages within the Meta Center's website. And it's been hard to even cope with all of the information about altruism, empathy, mm-hmm. mirror neurons, covering the entire range of science. And of course, on this program, we recently interviewed Franz Dewall and Rachel McNair, and we're going to do more stuff like that.
Right. And that would be really amazing as well, because what Gandhi was looking for was a nonviolence of the brave, he called it, which was really coming at nonviolence from a different worldview altogether. And a lot of what we're reporting on is not that kind of nonviolence at this point. So let us continue to search for our ideal while dealing with what is in the world, but there's a lot more potential of nonviolence out there. Do you agree?
Stephanie, you are challenging me to widen the lens on nonviolence in the news.
Can you believe it?
Can you believe it's happening right here on the air? This is not even planned.
Welcome back, everybody, to Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and we just had a thrilling set of news from Michael Negler's segment on nonviolence in the news. Thank you for that, Michael.
You're welcome, Stephanie, and thank you for the challenge.
Now, you're welcome, Michael. So, death. What does death have to do with nonviolence? And we're talking about death now because it's the Halloween season and it's the Day of the Dead season, so we thought that it would be a fun theme for the end of the month on Peace Paradigm Radio. But it's there's probably no more of a relevant topic than death with nonviolence, because here's a refrain that I hear all the time when we talk about nonviolence. There's misconceptions in the culture about what it means. And they say, you expect me to go out and get killed? Right. So what they're saying is that there is an underlying fear of death in our culture and a fear of the ineffectiveness of nonviolence to solve our problems, and all we'll do is die. And so let's unpack that a lot, not even just a little bit. Let's unpack that a lot about our own feelings about death and how it influences as well our feelings about nonviolence. And so, Michael, why don't you lead us into this with a discussion of the nonviolent escalation curve. Is nonviolence about dying? and where does it come in?
Stephanie, we're touching on a very interesting paradox, I think, because nonviolence is about living. It's about, if you recall the famous definition of violence, and by contrast, nonviolence that Johann Galtung gave us. He said, violence is the unnecessary inhibition of human fulfillment. So nonviolence is the restoration of human fulfillment and human life to its highest potential. But there is this paradox, and you mentioned the escalation curve. We have drawn this graph. You'll find it on page 108 of Search for a Nonviolent Future. Excellent book, that. If you think of the way that conflict can quickly escalate, it makes kind of a reverse saddle curve. You know, it starts off flat and starts to rise and then suddenly shoots up. It's very pretty. And the lower end of the curve is where people are not terribly dehumanized and you can use what we know as conflict resolution. That's when you can do the petitioning. That's when you can sit around and have discussions. But there comes a point where people aren't listening to you anymore, as in the news item that I just reported from the UK. And so at that point, you have to escalate from petitioning and nonviolent conflict resolution to satyagraha, or resistance. And now satyagraha is very powerful. Often it works. It almost always works when people know how to do it correctly, but that information is not very widely available in our world. So if you've done your satyagraha and the opponent still hasn't responded, what are you going to do? Well, there is an ultimate weapon that you can employ, if I use that expression, and that is based on the theory that the more you renounce, the more power you have. Right? So the most precious thing we possess is life. And if you remember, Carl Jung said at the end of his career, after psychoanalyzing so many patients, in the deepest consciousness of every single person he worked with, what he found was the fear of death. So to be able to overcome that fear gives you an enormous power. But this is a little different from saying going out and getting killed. It's going out knowing that you might get killed. It's the risk. And very, very often in nonviolence, that risk is enough. And you don't end up getting killed. And people forget to mention that when you go out with a weapon to protect yourself, you're far more likely to get killed than if you go out without one. Now, there is an incredible story, or more than one, about Gandhi. He was touring North India somewhere, and his people in the district who received him, they're very happy to have him there, but they said, Gandhiji, don't go to this particular village because the headman in that village has sworn to kill you on sight. So to their consternation, Gandhi said, terrific, where is he? Let's go. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But by golly, off he went with a few followers to this village, said, where's the head man live? Knocked on the man's door. Door opened, there he is, face to face with Gandhi. Gandhi said to him, I'm here to help you fulfill your vow. Sure enough, the man puts his hands around Gandhi's slender throat and proceeds to start throttling him. Gandhi doesn't raise an arm to defend himself. He probably is reciting his mantra like crazy, Rama, 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 looking this man in the eye. And after what must have seemed like an interminable minute, the village headman dropped his hands, fell at Gandhi's feet, and turned the whole village over to him. Mm-hmm. So I'm not suggesting that we do this, because I'm not Gandhi. But I am saying that if we understand what happened here, we can get a glimpse of a tremendous power that's accessible to us the more we are able to renounce our clinging to, ultimately, even to life itself.
Mm-hmm. Gandhi said that life and death birth and death were two phases of the same reality. So as opposed to seeing them as distinct or seeing death as something that is scary, that it's a natural process of the same thing that birth is. Can you say a little bit about that, of what that looked like in practice? Because when we talk about overcoming the fear of death, that's a really hard thing to achieve, no matter how cavalier we are in saying, oh, I'm not afraid of anything. I'm not even afraid to die, without even having any inner discipline to achieve that. Do you think that's possible? Do you think that that fear of death goes away very easily?
Very easily? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I think it's the hardest thing. And I think it's a measure of what Gandhi did achieve within himself to be able to lay that down. Mm-hmm. And it's quite rare. And it doesn't always work in quite the same way that it, quote, worked, unquote, for Gandhiji. We always remember the story of Father Maximilian Kolbe, who was in Auschwitz, and 10 men were selected to die a horrible death. Now, here are people who are in a concentration camp. You might think that, what could be worse? But it shows you how primal this fear of death is. And incidentally, I must just put in brackets here, a very dear friend of mine got a brain cancer due to being exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam. He was on life support, and he told his wife and daughter, okay, I'm ready to die now, take me off. So they unplugged him, and I don't know, maybe about 20 minutes later, he revived, and he signaled desperately, plug me back in. So he thought that he had overcome his fear of death, and if I were to tell you I'm not afraid to die, I would be only talking about the surface level of my consciousness. But Maximilian Kolbe was rather different, and he stepped up to the commandant, and because he spoke perfect German, in fact, they had offered him to be considered Volksdeutsch, ethnically German, and let him go. He refused. He said to the commandant, I have a favor to ask of you. You can imagine what a shock this was, to be asked by a prisoner at Auschwitz. The commandant was startled, said, what's your favor? He said, I want to die in place of that man. So there was a man who had been hauled off to die this horrible death. And he had been crying bitterly, my wife, my child, I'll never see them again. It touched something in Kolbe. And he was a Catholic priest. He stepped forward and said, I'm going to sacrifice myself for this man. Now, it didn't, quote, work, unquote, because Kolbe, in fact, did die a few days later. But it worked, no quotes, in the sense that it totally changed the moral atmosphere in that camp.
Yeah, for those who are just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and we're talking about death and nonviolence and what they have to do with one another. And I'm thinking about another argument made about nonviolence being ineffective and the problem of death, which is, look at Gandhi, look at King, look at all of your nonviolent heroes. They're all dead. And my response to that is, look at your violent heroes, too. Mm-hmm. They're dead, too.
Uh-huh.
What's the difference?
I think our violent heroes, I'm not going to put any detriment on their courage, but they died without changing much. Mm. Whereas, like Gandhi, King, and the rest, they died for a new future. if you're not renouncing something that you care deeply about, it's not going to have much power.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can show people that you do care very deeply, and yet you are still renouncing it in favor of a higher cause, that has power. And now we don't have to go quite as far as laying down our life, but the whole general question of suffering in Satyagraha, people will sometimes bring up, well, look at these poor peasants. They suffered so terribly and it didn't change anything. The difference, again, is that they didn't suffer voluntarily. Again, I'm not, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, blaming them or lacking sympathy for them. But the suffering in Satyagraha is taken on voluntarily, and it is in place of inflicting suffering on another. Do you remember that line, Stephanie, from the Gandhi film where it's in the Empire Theater, and just over what, September 11th, 1906, and Gandhi says, I don't know if he historically said this, but it was certainly in character. He said, this is a cause for which I, too, am prepared to die. But, my friends, he said, there is no cause for which I am prepared to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed everything.
And that's a very important principle in nonviolence, the willingness to lay down one's life without being willing to sacrifice another in your place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the word sacrifice, I mean, sacrifice originally comes from an act where you sacrifice others, namely innocent animals.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about sacrificing something that's precious to oneself. And it's that giving up of something that you cherish, that you cling to, that generates the power in the situation.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk a little bit about some of the stories that help us to understand that nonviolence is about holding on to this vision of life and not fearing death. And I'm thinking about one from the Indian tradition, which is the story of Markandeya. Can you tell that story for us, Michael?
Yes, Markandeya was a teenager, and he was scheduled to die at age 16, and he was the Yama, the king of death, came for him, riding on a water buffalo with a lasso, the way Yama does. But Markandeya was deeply, deeply devoted to Shiva, and he took refuge at Shiva's feet, and Shiva held up his hand and said to Yama, stop, you cannot take this boy. Now, I think the meaning of that story is that through our dedication to a much higher ideal, in a sense, we've overcome death already. We have seen that there's a higher objective than clinging to this physical life. Of course, I want to say that I think in stories like this, the fact that in India, belief in reincarnation is just kind of second nature doesn't really enter into it here, because there's still that fear. You know, every person is going to cling to the life that we've got, whether you believe in the surface consciousness that there's another one or you don't.
Mm-hmm. And that idea of clinging to something as well, I hear that translated in my mind as to, again, Satyagraha, because Gandhi said that even more than God being truth, truth is God. Mm-hmm. And so in the story of Gandhi as Markandeya, clinging to truth, which is, you know, seeing beyond this reality of seeming reality of fear of death to embracing and holding on to the truth that, as he said, birth and death are parts, phases of the same state.
In that context, I think that clinging to truth has to be understood dynamically. That, in other words, you're not just clinging to some ideas that you have, but you're clinging to a search for truth. Because you remember, Gandhi felt that this was an ongoing search and it would never really reach a conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in Goethe's Faust, if I could just have a literary lapse here for a minute, Goethe says that if God were, Faust says, that if God were to appear before him with a gift in each hand and say, in one hand I have truth itself, die Wahrheit selbst, and in the other hand I have this striving for truth, which would you choose? And Faust said, as a human being, I have to take the striving for truth, because the possession of absolute truth is not possible for us. But once you have found a higher truth, an avenue towards the highest truth, let's say, and you cling to that, in a sense, as I've said before, you're a little bit liberated from death already.
Mm. That striving for truth, mm-hmm. as you said, you feel that that helps us to become liberated from the fear of death. Can you say more about that?
I'm not sure I can say more about mm-hmm. it, Stephanie. It's kind of a hunch at this point, but that image of Markandeya brought it up for me. It has to be said that, by and large, nonviolence is very much on the side of life. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the Utpor uprising that took place in 2000 in Belgrade and other parts of Serbia, this student-led uprising, there's a very good film on this called Bringing Down a Dictator. At the end of the film, I think it's Sergei Popovich says, we won because we were on the side of life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. I think it's extremely important. People will always gravitate towards that when they recognize it. But we shouldn't overlook the fact that people in uniform who go out in a military action are convincing themselves that they are doing this for others. Mm-hmm. And I think that gives them a lot of their motivation. And as far as that goes, I think we have to approve of it and acknowledge their selflessness.
That's the human part of them that
is
led into the other acts that they're convinced and trained to do.
That's the tragedy, that their higher human impulses are being harnessed to a harmful cause. Mm-hmm. So now when you do it in nonviolence, you're harnessing it to a helpful cause. And I think we need to add to this also that when you're out there struggling nonviolently for a betterment of the human condition, your own welfare is included. But I have often had students say to me that how come these people got killed? They were practicing nonviolence. And I had to say, you know, if you're practicing nonviolence in order to protect your own personal life, it's not going to work. The nonviolence isn't going to work and the protection isn't going to work.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was trying to get at.
I sensed you were. Mm-hmm. So it's a subtle thing, isn't it? Because you don't go out marching out there saying, I'm going out to protect my own interests and those of others who will be included. You actually go out there with the feeling that I don't care what my interests are. I'm ready to renounce them in favor of a higher good. But your own interests are ultimately included in that higher good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Michael, what are your other favorite stories from any tradition? Maybe you can pick your one favorite story from any tradition that helped you to understand the meaning of your life in relationship to death.
Wow. Well, there's one that springs to mind.
Mm-hmm. There's so many stories in the world. I mean, the whole tradition of the wisdom traditions in particular is always talking about this topic.
Well, in the wisdom tradition, they point out that slowly but surely, if you're carrying out spiritual disciplines in tiny little incremental ways, inch by inch, you are, in a sense, laying down your life.
And let's define spiritual here in terms of understanding one's own welfare included mm-hmm. in the welfare of others.
What I was thinking of there was my own experience in meditation. Mm-hmm. And very often when I'm having a distraction, I have to pull my mind back. I recognize that the distraction is coming from my ego, which is the artificial construct that I think is me. And so it's like, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that this is a tiny little death. I'm sacrificing a part of something that I think I am for a higher something that I'm not yet convinced that I am. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I'm rehearsing over and over again for the ultimate physical fact of death when something comes and claims the body and I can't function in it anymore.
You know, and this reminds me, before you get into your story, I'm going to give you a minute to think about it, okay? Because that was a big question, and I know you know a lot of stories. The idea that you've talked about it before, and you talk about it in Search for a Nonviolent Future, that we don't want ice cream. What we want is the cessation of the desire for ice cream. So after we've had ice cream, we feel really good about it. And we feel really good for a bit because the craving has ceased, at least for a small period of time. Mm-hmm. And this ongoing agitation in the human mind, in the human body, and as you said, you know, with having these kind of smaller moments that remind you of what death could be like as a kind of a cessation. I think that to me is very interesting because it actually, if you see where I'm going with it, mm-hmm. it does suggest that if death is a cessation of the desires of the human body, even, you know, for all of eternity, well, that might be not a state to fear at all, because that's what we're seeking with the cessation of our small desires every day.
Wow. I think Socrates would agree with you. And I think in the Vedantic tradition, it's held, however, that our desires carry over.
Am I guessing that your favorite story of death is from Socrates on trial and what he says during his apology? What's the last line that he says about that? Because that's it might be a good note to end it on.
It wasn't the story I was thinking of, actually, Stephanie, but what the heck? I mean, yeah, he says, well, gentlemen, the time has come for us to part, for you to go on living and for me to die. And he says, hapateras haemon erketai epi amenon pragma adelon esti panti plen eto theo, which means, and which of us goes to a better fate is invisible to all but God. Hmm. So it's a very ennobling sentiment indeed. Mm-hmm. But the story I was thinking of, if we could just take it back to another more recognizable form of nonviolence mm-hmm. for a minute. I had a friend in Paris, Alain Richard, who was very good, had been all over the world, early worker with Peace Brigades International. We were talking about the word nonviolence and how it doesn't work. And one day he said he was at a big meeting of village people in sub-Saharan Africa somewhere. And he said, okay, how many of you have actually experienced or practiced nonviolence? Nobody raised their hand. So he thought for a second. He said, okay, how many of you have used a moral defense against a physical force? Bang, the hands shoot up. And he calls on one woman. My husband used to beat me a lot. One day, something came over me, and I stood up, I looked him in the eye, and said, why don't you just kill me and get it over with? End of the story, he never hit her again.
That's a very dramatic story, and I wish that we could talk a lot more about that one. So thank you, everybody, for listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. This has been another wonderful episode. Thank you to everybody at our mother station, KWMR. Thank you to everyone at the Meta Center, and thank you to all of our listeners. Until the next time, take care of one another and stay happy.